Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I never felt like my dad resented having to parent us. And he must have. There must have been moments where he just couldn't handle it anymore. But how could he? I mean, it would be absolutely bonkers if he could have at all times. But we never felt that.
This week, we're delighted to be joined on the podcast by Seamus O'Reilly, who is a Derry-born writer for The Observer, The New York Times, and more. And his new memoir, Did You Hear Mammy Died, will be released next year. In October 1991, 3 weeks before his sixth birthday, Seamus, his father, and his 10 brothers and sisters lost their mom, Sheila, to breast cancer after having battled it for the previous 4 years. Seamus, thanks so much for coming on. And I have to be honest, I really want to hear more about Sheila. I've read a little bit of parts of your book, and I just wanted to ask you, how does it feel to write about her now, all these years later, and to write about the experience of losing your mom at such a young age?
It's difficult. One of the things that's difficult is that I was so young that, first of all, my first-hand memories are quite limited. In the book, I actually go through them and discover that I have less than I thought I did. And then over the course of writing the book, I realized that I actually was able to uncover new memories. So actually writing the book, I found three new sort of memories of my mum. So from a logistical point of view, it's actually quite difficult. I was just about to turn six, so there's not that much memories that survive from that time anyway. So that is difficult. In terms of actually the sort of emotional wrench, I've actually found it really nice because I very rarely get to actually talk about her as a person or this part of my life in particularly great detail. Usually it's a thing that is very much dealt with in the early stages of a conversation when it turns to family, because the two things about my family that will come up at a dinner party or just a sort of normal conversation are that it's monstrously stupidly large. So and that also it's very sad and tragic that my mum died. And I think anyone who's had long-term bereavement like that, particularly something that happens in childhood, is it becomes so baked into your story that you know, you catch yourself, and I've had this conversation with so many other people who were from broadly similar circumstances. You have almost like a little business card version of the story. They say, oh, yes, well, before I tell everyone that I've got 10 brothers and sisters, about 20 or 30% of the time I've ever said that to people, they've come back and said, oh my God, you're per mum. And then I have to go in and say, oh, well, actually, my mum died. And it's like, you almost have to weigh up. You have to structure your plea almost so that no one, you get in there before someone offends you accidentally or gets offended or becomes
uncomfortable.
And yes, you're managing other people's reactions to the thing. And for so long, that was my experience of talking about this stuff. It was quite superficial. It was also, I felt like I'd already dealt with this or had already failed to deal with it. And therefore, but it was whatever was done was done. And it was more I've talked about the absence of my mother rather than a presence of a particular form of grief. But obviously, as is probably pretty predictable, that's not the case. You still have so many things you work through, even if it is actually the absence. You can chart that absence. You can log that absence throughout your life, how it comes and goes in the strangest and most predictable ways, you know. So that's been good.
You write about the moments in your life, and you write, I mean, beautifully about the moments in your life that she wasn't there for. The girlfriends, the texts, you know, the, talking about it, not ever knowing what a text message was, or talking about the internet, or all of these things that have happened. When there are these big moments in life and in the world and in our, as we change and evolve, especially this year, do you think about her? Is that something that you think about and, wow, she's not part of this?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of was going through that little bit in the opening chapter, which talks about all the things that she never got to do. And it started off from, you know, the most obvious stuff that you'd talk about is, you know, personal stuff. I didn't, you know, when I was a kid, it was things like, because I was so little, and it was like my first communion, or, you know, your childhood kind of revolves around these little, I am the center of the universe moments. Like, you know, a first communion is like, you know, you're getting married to God kind of a thing. You're in your little wedding outfit and everything. And I remember that. I remember at the time that was a thing that I was like, oh, you know, I wish I, you know, had her there. But then as I grew older, I didn't really think about those things quite so much, because I had so much less of a benchmark that she would be there for those things. And it was only when I was going through those things for the book that I realized she never sent a text message. she never sent an email. And I was like, she never even sent a text message. You know, she probably never met anybody who had a mobile phone. You know, it's just all these little weird things of like, I mean, she died in the middle of Bryan Adams's 18-week run at number one for Everything I Do It For You, whatever that song was called. She was in week 14 of that 18. And I find, even for me, who knows this story very, very well, it places it in such a specific place and time that whenever I would tell people that, this is always in October 91, says, oh my God, that's so long ago. And says, yeah, do you remember Bryan Adams was number one for 18 weeks? It's like, yeah, yeah, that's when it happened. And it's weird how placing things in those contexts, whether it's things that they miss, things that they're connected to. First of all, there's something profane and hopefully slightly funny about referring to these very silly touch points. Like, I didn't mention, you know, her relation to, like, I don't know, the Berlin Wall falling down or anything. It was, you know, Bryan Adams at number one. But it did strike me. It was like, God, that seems so long ago, but it doesn't seem that long ago. It seems like it's compartmentalized in a different part of my brain. And then as I got older, I think, you know, my wife would often say she really regrets she never got to meet her and stuff. And now that I've got a kid, that has really kind of come into the next level where my son understands that he's got his granddad in Derry and he's got his granddad and his nana, who will not be called granny, by the way, and that they're in Dublin. And that's it. It never occurred to him that he should have a full set of four. But at some point, there's going to be that conversation. And all of my brothers and sisters have had that conversation with some very heartbreaking, you know, elements to that conversation, but also some very funny elements. My nephew, my nephew Ardal, I can talk about this because I've gotten permission to write about it before. It's not in the book, it was in a newspaper column. But Ardal, my nephew, he was five, and he was explaining to Maeve, my sister, that, you know, it's very sad that you can't see your mummy anymore, but we should build a robot of Granny O'Reilly. And then if that didn't work, then he would get his own father to dress up as Granny O'Reilly. But both of these options were dismissed out of hand. But yeah, that's the only times really I really kind of reappraise it, really, in my own personal life, because whenever you have to see it through their eyes.
It's so funny how kids do that. Like my daughter, because my parents are, she knows both my parents are dead. She's not even four yet, but she knows that they're dead. And she says, but that's okay, mommy, because you've got me now. And it actually makes so much sense. Because she's like, well, you've got me now, so everything's fine. And it weirdly is very comforting to me. I'm like, yeah, you're right. I'm your mom now. And okay, cool. We got this. It's just a funny way that they can put these things into, like, you know.
Yeah. And also the sort of the unstudied speech of it, where it's a very genuine reaction. Even though we've obviously been counseled, and thankfully, I think, you know, we've been convinced away from talking that way about emotions. You know, we are slightly more tactful. But there's truth to that. There's the fact that one thing I think I came to quite early was every single person's parents are going to die. I got an early go at it. And that was a way, probably a quite a dismissive way in my own head of just kind of putting the feelings away. But it's also true. And the other side effect of that is that I occasionally feel like a complete fraud when asked to counsel anyone with, you know, I mean, you know, not professionally, I mean, just in normal life, you know, if a friend is bereaved or particularly if they lose their parents. And I feel like I don't really actually have specific Seamus O'Reilly advice to give other than just advice I would give anyone because I was five and I don't feel, I feel often that I didn't even feel the same grief as my older brothers and sisters or my younger siblings. It's so personal and it's so hard to kind of come up with a prescription for how to deal with it or what is the correct way to deal with it. And I think my growing up dealing with the shame of not remembering enough about my mother, of you know, feeling like, oh, I'm having a really happy day. Oh, but shouldn't I be sad because my mom is dead? You know, those kinds of things. You get a crash course and all that kind of stuff. And the problem is if you do it at a very young age, before you're emotionally mature enough to give yourself a break, it can bake in a lot of things. And, you know, I think we all know people who've had that experience and it's, you know, it's traumatized them in ways that they don't appreciate. And I think I do kind of search myself for that. Is my constant need for people to pat me on the head and say I'm very funny and very smart and please put me in your newspaper, sir. You know, is that just looking for approval that I feel like I didn't get? Or, I mean, there's plenty of people here like that whose mums didn't die. So, I mean, sometimes I run the risk of pathologizing everything as having a meaning when it could be due to loads of other factors as well.
Can I just ask you something, what you said about memories? Because my youngest son would have actually been exactly the same age when his dad died. And, you know, he often says to me, he's eight now, and he often says to me, oh, I can't remember daddy's voice. Or I can't, did daddy have long hair or short hair when he died? We can't pinpoint things. And sometimes I catch him making up little things because that suits him in his head as the right way to remember Martin. And I'm just wondering if you did that or if there's sort of like a slightly romantic view you have of your mum that...
Oh, that's sounds so true in my experience. The thing with my mum is... Well, my mum, Sheila, was an incredibly well-loved woman. She was... basically a very, very caring, very kind. She was a teacher. Obviously, she had 11 children, and she and my father. And she was committed Catholic. She was very religious, but she was also very undogmatic. So she wasn't someone who was a judgmental kind of a person. I mean, she only lived in Derry for the 6 years that I was there, because we lived in Enniskillen before that. And there was like over 1,000 people at the funeral. That's how many people that she touched. So in the sense of like things about her that are very larger than life, and she was so well loved. I mean, I went through my entire life having women stop me in the street and say, you're Sheila O'Reilly's boy, sit me down, tell me how much they loved her and everything, all these other things, and tell me these lovely things that she did for them. And she worked in different charities and did all these things. So obviously no one is going to tell you, particularly as a child, bad things about your mother. Because I mean, that's, you know, it's, you don't speak ill of the dead. And what it's kind of had that effect whenever I was younger, that I started to have this real kind of hero worship thing. She was very saintly. The only things, you know, she was this person watching us on the wall from a beautiful portrait, and I wanted to find the real stories, the real things, because I didn't have enough memories of my own to form a proper coherent picture. So I would gravitate to, like, for example, her best friend, Patricia, who still lives in Enniskillen and who would come and see us, you know, quite often. And I would ask us to tell us what was the most annoying thing about Mummy? What was the thing about her that you couldn't stand? Is it, well, you know, and Patricia in her amazing South Fermanagh twang would be like, well, you know, she had a singing voice that would disprove the existence of God. And, you know, And she would go on these long things, and she'd say, well, she was an awful, in school, she was an awful suck up. You should have seen her. She was all, oh, miss, I know the answer. You know, and those kinds of things, like we just gravitated because it humanized it and it made everything else more believable. It's like, I can believe that this person has been this wonderful and done all these great things. If also, you know, she used to kind of like be a bit of a suck up, or, you know, she couldn't sing, or she was terrible at cooking this thing or that thing or whatever. So those kinds of things happened that I was like trying to find extra little elements. But I did find that sometimes I would either make up or attach greater significance to things. So for example, if a woman, I remember a woman was gave me, I went, there was like a blood donation van in our school. You know, you go give blood. So it was like, probably about 10 or 11. It was in primary school anyway. So I went, they do it. They give you a lollipop afterwards. And she said, as loads of women have done, and people have done, you're Sheila O'Reilly's boy. And I said, yeah, yes, of course. And she would tell me this and that. And I was like, this woman who probably met my mum a couple of dozen times because they probably just worked in the school system or whatever, she probably has more coherent memories of my mother right now than I do. Just from being a workmate, an adult. And so I would try and supplement this with like something that I knew about her. And it would usually, I mean, I think the example I give in the book is, you know, she went on this big spiel about how she was so lovely and she was so great and whatever else. And as she's dabbing away the blood from my arm, I say, yes, yes. And she was allergic to bees, of course. because I had so little to talk about her as an adult or as a person. I just had a sort of a list of facts and a sense of her good deeds, but I didn't. I'm so grateful for the fact that my dad's kept so many pictures and recordings. We have like sort of old camcorder footage and stuff like that, which I realize now is so rare. I mean, God, all of our kids have got such a massive paper trail of stuff. I mean, which is its own problem, I'm sure, but compared to so many other people, like, we do have videos, we do have pictures. And just recently, last year, my dad was digitizing some tapes, and he found a recording, and it's the only time I've ever heard my mum say my name is on tape. And it's very odd why it makes a difference, you know?
Oh, I can imagine.
I don't know what that means. It's not like I presumed that she'd never said my name or whatever, but it was a difference hearing. Her, and she's scolding me for like messing around in front of the camera when we're supposed to be taking a family photo, and my dad is secretly filming it at the same time, thank God. And he's saying, and she's saying, you know, in her Fermanagh accent, sort of, Seamus, get away. And I'm like, oh my God.
Can I ask you about your dad, Seamus? Because he sounds like a pretty incredible person. You describe what he went through, like, and I might be saying this wrong, but that you were surprised he didn't go flamboyantly insane, which is probably my new favorite phrase. But I definitely think from hearing what he went through and what you guys all went through, it probably is a surprise that with 11 children and to lose your wife and the woman you love so much, that he didn't go flamboyantly insane, but he didn't, and he was very much there for you all. What does he mean to you, and how did he kind of help you guys navigate these waters?
Well, I mean, my dad, it means everything to us. He's kind of a sort of a low-level deity anyway, and not that he wears it too lightly. He knows he's very well thought of, but it's really astonishing. And as you get older, it becomes even more astonishing. Obviously, none of us, his 11 children, have 11 children ourselves, so we can't compare that. But, you know, some of us have got, I've got one child, some of us have got three or four. And I think every time, it's like every year that we get older, we realize just how difficult it would have been and how difficult we couldn't have comprehended at the time. But my dad, you know, he's got the work ethic of a soldier ant, and it's really incredible, because there's so much stuff, even though we didn't take things for granted compared, I think, to loads of other people, we really took things for granted. We got the right to take things for granted because he just provided so much sort of emotional space and support. I think obviously the most basic stuff was, you know, he just kept on trucking, he kept working, he kept his head together. He'd never really been a drinker at all. My mum didn't drink at all. She was a Pioneer with a little pin. My dad would have the occasional drink, and he pretty much just stopped entirely because he said, that's one more thing that I don't want to be the story. I think because we'd had family, and I think everyone in Ireland has that story or has that background where, oh Jesus, your poor old Joe O'Reilly, God, you know, he's gone to the drink or something like that. I mean, that was very prevalent. That was a worry that he had. That
normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Any sort of thing that he did would be seen as almost understandable. So like any crutch that he leaned on would be understandable. And he didn't want pity, he didn't want sympathy, and he didn't want to feel as if he was being, as if there was any way that he could get out of his full responsibility. So he just cracked straight on.
I mean, that's quite an incredible thing to do, to be so emotionally aware of his kids' needs, and especially because there's so many emotions kids have when they're dealing with the grief of a parent. And it tends to be one big round one day and the next day the other one isn't. And it's sort of, so you're constantly on. So I can't imagine, I have three and I can't imagine with 11, how emotionally draining that must have been for him.
Yeah.
And at times incredibly upsetting.
Yeah, I mean, I think as I kept writing and writing, and I just kept thinking, I can't imagine how this happened or how this went. And I was there. Like, I just can't understand that level of strength, because I mean, God knows how any of us would fare if we were ever so tested, but the circumstances are so baroque that it's hard to contrive another test case for what my dad went through, where he was bereaved in his early 40s with 11 children on a single civil servant's wage, and we're way out in the countryside. The troubles are very far from being over, and we're on the border of Derry and Donegal. And you know, there's all these quite outsized things. But what my dad would always say is, "Well, what did you expect me to do?" And I was like, "Well, it's like whenever we say, Jesus, Daddy, how did you deal with all 11 kids?" Which we say with alarming frequency, his 11 children. And he always says, which is quite a sweet sort of thing to say, he says, "Sure, which of these would I give back?" And then, of course, we suggest a few options, each of us. I think how he's dealt with it is, in sort of practical sense, is amazing. But it's also the emotional support. So my dad is quite emotionally intelligent. Surprisingly so, I think, for a man of his vintage and the part of the world he grew up. Certainly our family we were huggy. We were very sarcastic, but we're very loving. We're open with our emotions. We were never told not to cry. We were very open, particularly after my mother died. We were very free with telling people that we love each other. And I don't think I thought that was a strange thing, or not a strange thing. I didn't think that was a novel thing until I was getting a bit older and going around to other people's houses. Whenever you're maybe about 10 or 11, you'd start going to your friends' houses. And I saw that those fathers did not do that.
Now, I remember talking to Marco Pierre White, the chef, about this, and he was 6 when his mum died. And they were all sort of divvied out to various relations. And that sort of was quite the norm at that time, where it's something I couldn't even imagine doing to my kids and after the grief they've gone through.
Yeah, I I can't. I that's completely gobsmacking. I think an awful lot of the way that you hear about certain strands of British society where parenting, you can tell that parenting is difficult because when you get sufficiently rich, you outsource it immediately. And I think as a parent, I find this, if there's one thing that I cannot stand, I think it's the abdication of responsibility. And I think that comes from my father in parenting sense, particularly of men. I can't stand even a sort of quasi-jokey thing where a guy's like, oh, I don't know how to fold these things, or I don't know how to do nappies. I'm like, well, just do it. Just shut up.
Learn how to do it. It's funny. What are you talking about? I feel like I have like a lifetime example right now because my three-year-old, you might see me moving my head over and over again. My three-year-old has come in multiple times to give me a My Little Pony, and I was feeling stressed. And then I thought, 11 children and able to kind of come to a place where you're able to handle that through such a loss. You know, when you're parenting, like, your own child, and now that you're doing that yourself, do you feel like you have sort of a superpower a little bit because you've got like a lot of this amazing example of a human being that raised you, or do you still find that it's just as hard as everybody else?
I'd say it's almost certainly the latter, unfortunately. isn't it annoying that those little shots of perspective you get, they're so bright, but they last so fleetingly. You know, I can literally right now talk to you at length about how incredible it was and how difficult it was what my dad went through. And then I will go downstairs and I will consider myself, you know, the hardest done by person in the world because I have to clean more yogurt off the fridge handle walls. And the walls and the, you know, and Ready Breck is just sticking to every surface. And, you know, I think if you live your entire life with a constant battery of perspective, you know, being evenly doled out, your life would be pretty much unlivable. And I think one of the great luxuries and privileges that I am aware of is that the reason that I'm able to be slightly more blasé is because my family life was so much better than it could have been. And because I, you know, it's a privilege of being able to take things for granted, but it's I'd kind of like it if my children, by virtue of the things that I do for them, are able to take a few things for granted. And some of those things are the emotional things, and some of those things are, you know, practical things. You know, I think it's, you know, kind of like then everyone kind of hopes that their children have a bit more money than they did growing up. But then whenever, if that does happen, you're like, oh, I never knew anybody like my children growing up. Yeah. So how do you get that balance? It's the story of all those mid-noughties reality shows like The Osbournes or Run's House or The Hiltons, where it's like parents raising children that have absolutely nothing in common with them. So I think the difference is probably not going to be so stark for us because I think we're just on track to get poorer and poorer now, thanks to...
You were saying there you've been asked to console people or give advice, whatever. And there will be parents who are bringing up their kids who have lost their other parent the same age as perhaps you were, or slightly older, as, you know, way before they should have. What would you say to those parents? What is the best thing that they can do for their child or children right now?
That's an incredibly good question. I can't say what the best thing is, but I can say things which, looking back, that I'm like, wow, I can't believe my dad was smart enough to do that. One is to try as possible to be open with your feelings and open with your emotions, but I never felt like my dad resented having to parent us. And he must have. I don't mean that in a sort of grand scheme at the end of the day when he thought about that, but there must have been moments where he just couldn't handle it anymore. How could he? I mean, it would be absolutely bonkers if he could have at all times. But we never felt that. I mean, when we were teenagers, we did, because I think by then, I think you're allowed to be a bit more. I think you're.
That's a whole.
Yeah, you're allowed. But I mean, it was business as usual in that most basic sense. Having said that, he was also very available for all of the waves of emotions that we felt. I mean, it's complicated in my sense because I also had 10 brothers and sisters. So when my mom died There was 11 of us between the ages of 2 and 17. So they had 11 kids in 15 years, which means that now that we're all adults, we kind of basically feel not grossly different in ages. You know, we really do. But as kids, you know, 3 years is like a lifetime. So I would talk to my immediately older siblings and immediately younger siblings, and we would talk about these things together. But we all got the same message from my dad, which was that it was okay to cry, it was okay to be sad, it was okay to be confused, angry, and that if we went and said that to him, if we went and said that to any of our siblings, that was fine. That wasn't weakness. That wasn't going to make people feel awkward and weird. Because a lot of the time, the main thing that stops you from coming forward with these things, even if you're a child, it's not someone saying, you know, some Clint Eastwood type character saying, yeah, don't show your emotions, because that usually doesn't really happen. It's more sort of, you notice the whole room grinds to a standstill, and you're like, oh, I'm not going to chill the air of a room again by bringing that up. No one wants to hear me talk about this. It's those subtle little things. And I never felt that. And I knew that I could, you know, even if we'd had the same conversation 6 months previously, I could go in and say, I'm sad, I can't sleep because mommy's, you know, on my mind. Mm. And, you know, you have to imagine I was not the only person going through that at that time for him. It could have had, you know, you were saying earlier, Sasha, that you've got, you know, child 2 and child 6 are having a problem, but child 3, 4, 5 and 9 are okay. Jesus, child 11 is doing their GCSEs or their A-levels. And then, just, you know, you've got so many other things going on. And it's astonishing to me that he was able to do that, was to provide, give us the emotional space and the emotional time to talk to him about these things, or just work them out on our own without ever seeming to resent it, without ever seeming to get impatient with us.
Well, I think that's great advice for not only someone who has lost someone, but just parents and people in general. I wouldn't even say parents, because one of the things, I mean, we talk so much in our culture about, like, talk about it, tell people how you're feeling, you know, be open, like, look, ring someone, go for a walk with someone. But the chill in the air that you're talking about is such a familiar feeling, because someone finally works up the courage. Okay, I'm going to say it. I'm still grieving, or I'm lonely, or I'm angry. Yeah. And maybe it's met with kind of a dead kind of, okay, or I don't really know what to do. And we could all do with maybe opening ourselves up to those things being okay. Seamus, thanks so much. It was such a wonderful chat. I can't wait to read the book.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.